From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. Hey, welcome to the program today. There is a great book out. It's called The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. You know, life and death are a package deal. They can't be pulled apart, and we cannot live unless we are aware of death. Well, this book, The Five Invitations, is an exhilarating meditation on the meaning of life and how maintaining an ever-present consciousness of death can bring us closer to our truest selves. It's a joy for me to have Frank Ostaszewski, the author of this great book, who's dedicated his life to service. He's the co-founder of the Zen Hospice Project, founder of the Metta Institute, a Buddhist teacher, an international lecturer, and a leading voice in contemplative end-of-life care. He's been honored by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and AARP named him one of America's 50 most innovative people. He's offered seminars at Harvard Medical School, the Mayo Clinic, and the Heidelberg University, and he teaches at major spiritual centers around the globe. His work has been featured on the Bill Moyers PBS series On Our Own Terms and the Oprah Winfrey Show, among other programs. It's an honor to have him with us today, and he joins us from his home in Northern California. Frank, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be with you, Richard.
I have followed your work for quite some time since you were on that Bill Moyers PBS special many years ago. I was a hospice chaplain at the time here in Indianapolis and was one of the many in many of the PBS stations across the country that were manning the phone lines and sending out information on that great special that Moyers put together.
Yeah, thanks for doing that. It was called On Our Own Terms, and yeah. Bill and I knew each other from some other circles. He invited me to be part of that, too. He was really trying to really change the way we look at death in America.
Yeah, he really was. I love this book that really has just come out, and I know you're doing a lot of traveling and seminars and workshops and such about this book. I wanted to start off by something in the introduction, the very first page. First of all, there's a beautiful Rilke quote. It says, "Love and death are the great gifts that are given to us. Mostly, they're passed on unopened." And the first sentence you write is, "Life and death are a package deal. You cannot pull them apart." And yet, Frank, it seems that we always are trying to pull them apart, especially when it comes to death in this country.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, we have a wish for mortality, for immortality. You know, all of us do in some way. I think our sense of self is terrified all the time of the dying process. But I think that we can find a deeper wisdom that can be with that fear. And that's what the book is all about. How do you go toward death and learn what it has to offer you about living fully?
Yeah. So much of who we are and what we eventually become is, I think, influenced by people that have influenced us. And so before we get into the book, I wanted you to share a little bit about your experience with a couple of them. One was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You did have the joy of working with her, being trained by her. And gosh, I can only imagine what that was like. But then also I'd like for you to share about somebody, he was near and dear in my heart. I never had the joy of meeting him. He was a very close friend of yours, and that was Stephen Levine, of course, his wife, yeah. Andrea. But can you share about both of those people, and what was it about them that had such an influence in you as you are now influencing so many people?
Well, thank you. I mean, Elizabeth, of course, was the great pioneer, the one who got us all on this path together. And I went to see her, honestly, when my son, my oldest son, Gabe, was being born. I wanted to understand how to bring his soul into his body. I sort of felt like that was my role. And she'd been so good at helping people get out of their bodies, I thought maybe she could give me some guidance. In effect, she wasn't so helpful in that regard, but she did sort of take me under her wing and allow me to sort of watch her.
Yeah.
Sort of shadow her.
Yeah.
And she was immensely intuitive and had a great big kind heart and was really brilliant at this work and fearless, absolutely fearless.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Levine had that same fearlessness. He was remarkably intuitive. He, of course, brought to his work something different than Elizabeth, which was a deep meditative practice, his Buddhist practice, but also from other traditions. And, of course, this really influenced the way in which he worked. And Stephen was extremely kind to me. When we first got the Zen Hospice going, I went to Stephen and I said, "How do you think it's going to be, you know, having this Buddhist hospice?" And he said, "It's going to be all right if you don't make it too Buddhist. That was a really good reminder for me to really, you know, not get stuck in any kind of ideology or dogma.
Yeah.
Stephen was really great at that. And he was really a great mentor for me, and then later a dear friend. And he and Andrea have been, you know, great, great supporters of my work. And, you know, most of what I have done, I have modeled on their work.
I remember having Elizabeth Lesser, one of the co-founders of Omega Institute, on the radio show talking about her book, Broken Open. And I asked her of the thousands of people, the authors and teachers who have gone through the Institute, who was your favorite? Can you even answer that? And without missing a beat, she said Stephen, because he was so authentic. When people would meet him, he wasn't anything like they thought he should be. And he was just a rare, very rare individual, also very heartfelt in his presentations.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he was a kind of rebel.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
He studied in a lot of different spiritual traditions, but he wasn't wedded to any one. And in that way, he could find his way into the heart of the people who came to his programs quite easily. He was very accessible, very real, and I modeled a lot of my work on what I learned from him.
Yeah, towards the end of our time together, I'd like to ask a little bit about the Zen Hospice project that you co-founded. But how did you follow a Buddhist path? Can we share just briefly about that for our listeners?
Well, sure. I mean, I think I got introduced to Buddhism quite early in my life, in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a family that had some troubles. Both my parents were alcoholics. It was a difficult family upbringing. They both died young, my mother when I was a teenager, my dad a few years later. And to be honest with you, Richard, I tried everything possible to avoid that suffering, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, I tried it all. And none of it worked, honestly. None of it worked in any lasting way, anyway. And when I came upon Buddhism, what it asked me to do was to turn toward that pain, to turn toward that suffering, and get to know it. It didn't ask me to believe anything. It just said, turn toward this experience.
Yeah.
And that was incredibly helpful to me. It was there that I really learned that turning toward that we were speaking about here is the ground of compassion.
Mm.
Right? And then it's become became a big part of my life, and it has been for the last 40-some-odd years.
Yeah. Yeah. In this book that we're talking about, the five invitations are don't wait, welcome everything, push away nothing, bring your whole self to the experience, find a place of rest in the middle of things, and cultivate don't know mind. Can you share how you came up with those invitations and what I thought was really hilarious, really, is how you came to write them down?
Well, the invitations really came from my working with people at the end of life.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, working with people oftentimes on the margins of society, people who lived on the streets of San Francisco. And so if I was going to be with them, I had to really be real.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to be clear about my intention. Otherwise, they would sniff out my sentimentality and my insincerity. And so those precepts really came out of what they taught me. What these folks showed me as they came into the final weeks, days, and hours of their lives.
Mm.
You mentioned earlier Bill Moyers, and Bill had invited, when he was preparing that show on our own terms, he invited a number of us back to Princeton to have what he called a teach-in on death in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so I prepared a very salient talk, a really great, lecture. And I was on this panel with some other people who were leading figures in the end-of-life movement, and they took up all the time, you know, and I never got to give my salient talk. and so Bill pulled me aside. We knew each other. He said, Frank, could you just, speak to the heart of the matter, you know? So on the airplane there, I had written down on a cocktail napkin, I was just trying to make some notes for myself, the five things that I had really learned from being with dying. And it was the five invitations that you just named. So when Bill asked me to speak briefly to his crew, I pulled out my cocktail napkin, you know. and they've actually been a kind of signature piece for me since then, you know.
Yeah.
Because they're so, they can work on multiple levels.
Uh-huh.
You know, at one level you can just look at them and say, don't wait. Okay, well, everybody understands that, you know, step fully into your life. But, of course, we can see the deeper and more subtle levels to those experiences, invitations as well.
Yeah, I think you refer to them as five bottomless practices.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we can live into them in order to know them, I think.
Yeah. Well, the first one is don't wait. And you talk about when people are dying, it's easy for them to recognize that every minute, every breath counts. But the truth is, death is always with us. And I know you're passionate about that, is helping as many people as possible to embrace their own mortality, that it's a really healthy and wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've probably worked with a few thousand people who have died. And, you know, a lot of them, honestly, came to their death full of fear, a significant amount of regret. And I just think it's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It's foolish to imagine that at the time of our dying, we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And so we need to do this work now. And rather than being a depressing activity, Richard, I think really what I find is that when we understand how precarious this life actually is, we come to see how precious it is.
Oh, yeah.
And then we don't want to waste a moment. We want to step into our life with both feet, you know. We want to embrace this life fully. We want to tell the people we love that we love them.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's the brevity of life. It's the precariousness of life that shows us what's really important. I talk about how in Japan the hillsides are covered with cherry blossoms in the spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or in Idaho, where I go to teach often, there are these beautiful blue flax flowers that last for one single day, you know? Now, why is it those cherry blossoms or those flax flowers are so beautiful to us? Isn't it their brevity which introduces us to their beauty?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true with our life as well.
Yeah.
You know, because things end, they are valuable. Because things end, we must invest fully, fully in this life.
Yeah. And Frank, we were talking about these five invitations. The second one is welcome everything, push away nothing. And there was a story in there that really tugged my heart. As a matter of fact, there was a phrase that I believe Carl, the individual is Carl, page 106. He was a homegrown philosopher, you said.
Yeah.
But I think he was the one that uttered the phrase, rest in love. Can you share his story with our listeners?
Oh, it's just a beautiful story. You know, Carl, and you're right about his name, he was a kind of grandpa to me, you know. You know, when we see ourselves and we see those we love in the people that we serve, it changes the way in which we care for them.
Yeah.
So Carl was, as you say, a homegrown philosopher. Here he was at this Zen hospice center, and of course he began to ask a bit about meditation and how it might be valuable to him, particularly in addressing his pain. And so he had stomach cancer, and so he had a lot of abdominal pain. And while we were giving him various medications to manage that pain, he wanted to see if meditation could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we began to orient his attention toward the very center of the pain, but it was too much for him. He just started to scream and yell. It was just too fierce. And so I put my hands on his stomach very gently, and I said, "How's that, Carl? How's that? Let's try something else." And he said, "That's nice, but it still hurts." And I pulled my hands away just 6 inches further, and I said, "How's that?" And he said, "Oh, that's a little better." And I pulled them away a foot further, and I said, "How's that?" And he said, "Oh, that's much better. That's much better." And I said to him, he said to me, "That's lovely." And I said, "Carl, could you just rest there for a moment?" And out of his mouth, not mine, he said, "Rest in love. Rest in love." And from that point forward, whenever he'd get in pain, he'd push his morphine pump. He continued to use the traditional medications we had. But then he would say, "Rest in love." So what happened for Carl? We didn't do any California woo-woo stuff. It wasn't any energy healing or anything like this.
Yeah.
It was just that we made more space for the pain. You know, we literally, he was going into it in a kind of laser-like way, and that didn't work. So we tried the opposite. We gave a little more space to the pain. You know? And whatever we can give space to can move, including our physical pain. Yeah?
Mm.
But this goes true for our mental, you know, discomfort and our emotional struggles as well.
Give
them a little space.
We don't often do that very well, especially in healthcare, do we? Giving space for the pain.
Yeah, well, we're so fixed on our solutions, you know,
yeah.
and trying to get rid of things that
mm-hmm.
we don't get to know the thing. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things that can help us get to know it, I mean, pain is a multi-layered experience. Of course, there's a physical component to it, but there's also mental and emotional components to our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to include that. If we're going to deal with what we might call total pain, we have to deal with the emotional and psychological responses to the physical experience.
Yeah, yeah. And so at the end of Carl's story, you also write, his wife, Carl's wife, came to visit a few days later.
Yeah.
She was a nervous woman, more anxious about Carl's condition than he was. She sat by his bed, her legs bouncing and fingers twitching, and Carl reached his hand through the bed rails and touched her lightly and said, "Rest in love, my dear. Rest in love."
Isn't that beautiful?
It brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah. And we forget about the healing power of human presence. You know, we forget about the healing power of love.
Yeah,
actually.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The third invitation is bring your whole self to the experience. And that's so important because, as you say, we all like to look good. And bringing our whole self, that sometimes means as parts of us, and physically even, as if we have cancer, what have you, it's not so looking good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's especially true at the end of our lives. You know, all the ways we've defined ourselves. I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a Buddhist teacher, I'm a radio interviewer. You know, all of these identities are often stripped away by illness or gracefully given up. And then we have to ask a more fundamental question, who are we? And so I think that when I say bring your whole self, I mean bring all of it, you know. Bring the beauty and capacity, great capacity that you have to be a human being. Bring that forward, but also bring your fear forward and bring your helplessness forward.
Yeah.
Particularly when we're accompanying somebody else who might be experiencing these things. You know, when I'm with somebody who's dying, I'm looking at my own fear. I'm looking at my own grief, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I form an empathetic bridge to their experience. If I'm unwilling to experience those things in myself, it's highly unlikely that I can be of any support to them when they're going through similar states of mind and heart.
Mm. What counsel do you give to families, and particularly in this chapter that we're talking about? First of all, you had a great Ram Dass quote. He said, "Don't be a role, be a soul." It seems so often we're putting on so many social masks that we've actually forgotten who we really are. And that's powerful. But this was a section where you were talking about a nurse who was working hospice, I think. A visiting nurse pulled me aside after meeting with the patient. It was about a medication.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this was early on in the hospice days, and this was back in the mid-80s. And she was a fill-in nurse. She came to see one of our patients, and the patient was weeks, days from death.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, she was a bit blue about this experience. It's a natural thing. You know, depression isn't always clinical depression. Sometimes it's just we feel lousy, and we don't feel good about what's going on. Anyway, this nurse came to see this particular patient, and came out of the room and said, "I think we should start some antidepressants." And I said, "Well, why do you think that?" And she said, "Well, the patient is so sad, you know, and she seems uncomfortable, and it's really uncomfortable for me to see her that way."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, maybe you should take the antidepressants." You know? And I was being a little facetious, but I was trying to really see that oftentimes we are medicating people for our discomfort.
Yes.
Sometimes we're doing this. You know, we cause people to be unnecessarily somnolent as a result of the drugs that they take.
Mm-hmm.
Pain management is a high art form, and we can do it without necessarily turning people into sleeping machines.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and you talked about an oncologist who was treating a particular patient, that they were overworked, they became shut down, molded by their training. Then they see only symptoms and not the person in front of them. I'm guessing early on there was a lot of that. That still can happen with doctors, regardless of what discipline they're practicing in. But in the area of hospice and death and dying, are you seeing a change in that where professionals are becoming more present with the people that they're working with?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is happening, you know, all across the country. There's much more discussion around end-of-life issues and how to address the psychological and emotional issues as well. You know, now we have in 5 states physician aid in dying, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what our moral view is on that, one of the things those particular laws have done is help raise the conversation around end of life.
Yeah.
And what do we want, and how do we want to go through this, and how much control do we get to have in the process?
Mm-hmm.
And so doctors, not just palliative care doctors, but doctors of all all different part on the whole continuum of healthcare are getting better educated about pain management, symptom control, and also how to address the issues that people face near the end of life.
Yeah.
So absolutely, I think it's improving. Having said that, I think that some of our hospice organizations are increasingly large healthcare providers on the continuum of care that are sometimes forgetting their roots mm-hmm. in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important that we remember, you know, that dying is not simply a medical event. It's much bigger than that. You know, it's much more about relationships. It's about our relationship with those we love, with the pain and suffering that we're experiencing with ourselves, with whatever image of God we hold in our lives.
Yeah. You know?
And so while we need to bring the best of what medicine has to offer, we have to also understand that it's not large enough to embrace the profundity of what happens in the dying process.
Yeah. Frank, you talk in this book about your own experience with your heart attack.
Yeah.
And what that was like. And that had to be that was a powerful teaching for you, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, anytime we, you know, touch the fragility of this human life, it can have a profound effect on us. I was teaching a retreat for doctors and nurses on compassion, and I began to have heart pain. And I denied it at first, honestly, mm-hmm. as a lot of people do when they mm-hmm. have heart conditions. But, you know, it became unbearable, and I went to the ER and I had a heart attack. You know, it's a different view from the other side of the sheets. You know, I've been caring for people for 30 some odd years, but it was really different to be the patient, you know, and I thought I knew a lot about dying, and I thought I knew a lot about caregiving, but I was really humbled by the experience. And it really, it showed me just how challenging it is to be a person receiving the care of other people. That was hard.
Yeah.
To be dependent, to be reliant on others for your care and for doing even the smallest of activities.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And when I was reading your story, I couldn't help but think of some of the patients that I had served some time ago, where sometimes they just didn't want to talk. But then I had to chuckle because I had to actually look up who are the blind boys of Alabama. That was the group you wanted to listen to shut out the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that can happen when you are in a hospital is that there's a procedure for everything and a protocol for everything. And thank God for those procedures and protocols. If not for them, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. They saved my life, medical procedures and protocols. But there is also in hospitals a tendency to lean into the future a little too much. You know, people would come in the room and they'd say, "How are you?" And I'd say, "Lousy. I feel lousy." And they'd say, "Well, you're going to feel better tomorrow." I said, "Yeah, but today I feel lousy, you know." And so it was very hard to find someone who could just be with me in what was difficult, you know, the emotional and physical difficulty, the psychological turmoil that was part of recovering from a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, I didn't want to hear anybody's advice. And so I was like a teenager. I put on a set of headphones, and I listened to the Five Blind Boys of Alabama. They were a great a cappella group. They've been singing spirituals for 50 years. Wonderful guys. But what had happened was, in this, in the hospital, in this environment of future thinking and only dealing with me as a problem, I began to lose contact with my own capacity to heal, with my own ground, in a way. And so what I needed to do was to really stabilize. And so I put on the Five Blind Boys, and they sing, you know, these beautiful spirituals from, you know, that go back hundreds of years. And in a way, what I did was I borrowed their connection to God. Even though it wasn't my same practice, I borrowed their faith. I borrowed their confidence, you know, until I could restore my own.
Yeah.
And so I would walk the halls with my IV pole, listening to the Five Blind Boys of Alabama, talking about having a very personal relationship with God. And it really did stabilize me. It really helped me enormously. You know, by the way, a sidebar to that.
Yeah.
A year later, after my heart attacks, I happened to go to a concert of these guys, and they're, you know, elders, and and they are blind. And I talked to one of the guys, and I said, "Hey, you know, you guys really saved my life." I said, "You know, I had a heart attack," and I explained the story again. And he said, "When?" And I told him when it was. And he said, "I had a heart attack that same week."
Oh, my God.
He said,
"God.
I was in the hospital
really?
That same week." I said, "Well, what helped you?" He said, "The guys came and sang to me."
That's what helped.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Huh?
Yeah, well, I think their album sales are going to spike because you share this story.
Oh, they're fantastic. They're just fantastic. Really great.
One of the things that I was intrigued with, and I loved the chapter, I was so glad it was in this book. There's been other authors writing books about what dying teaches about living. What I loved about yours was, first of all, the vast experience you've had over the years. And you're a gifted writer in how you write and how you share the stories. You had a chapter in there on taming the inner critic. Can you share why that is so important?
Yeah. I mean, we all got one, right?
Absolutely.
And we'd love to get rid of it. Here's the thing. The critic is a psychological structure which is meant to sustain our safety. You know, your mom and dad said, look both ways before you cross the street.
Mm-hmm.
They told you right from wrong. And we internalize that. Now, sometimes we internalize that voice, and it was really helpful to us. But other times, it just was kind of, the critic was just a standard bearer. It was the thing that said, do this or you'll get punished. You know, don't act out. You know, keep the status, protect the status quo.
Yeah.
So what that means is that when we're trying to grow, when we're trying to develop, the critic comes in and shuts that down. The critic comes in and says, no, in some particular way. And so we got to learn to address the voice of that critic, tame that critic, so that we can, in fact, develop. We can, in fact, grow.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we don't grow in our comfort zones. We grow on the edges of our life, you know. And the critic is always trying to keep us safe. And that's really important when you're 5 years old or 7 years old. But when you're an adult, it's really important to be safe enough to risk. You know?
Yeah, and I can't imagine having worked in hospice, but I've never had a doctor tell me face-to-face that I'm terminal. And there was a story in there that really struck me. It was a powerful story about Matthew, who was a gay man, longtime Buddhist practitioner. But he was raised in a fundamentalist Christian family. And he had all those teachings. It really began to haunt him.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not uncommon for people near the end of their lives to revert back or to come back into contact with very early training.
Sure.
Religious training, family training, cultural training.
Yeah.
Matthew was a longtime Buddhist practitioner, a dear friend of mine, actually. He was in the hospital, and he was dying of AIDS. He was a gay man dying of AIDS. And he was climbing out of his skin. And all of my efforts to try and support him just kind of didn't work, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had all of the Buddhist, you know, paraphernalia and tankas and statues and chanting music, all the things that he loved, but they were just kind of bouncing off this fear that was there. And as you say, Matthew was raised in a fundamentalist Christian family, and the commandments of God were literally beaten into him by his, you know, fire and brimstone father preacher. And so now he was dying. He was a gay man dying of AIDS, and he was really terrified that he would go to hell. And there was no talking him out of it. And I just couldn't help him at all. I really couldn't help him. So 2 o'clock in the morning, I left, went home, feeling helpless and unsuccessful. And on the way home, I remembered my first Holy Communion. I was a Catholic schoolboy. And I remember this little statue I had, a little plastic figurine of Jesus and the little children and the lambs and the little children.
Oh, yeah.
Little Jesus, yeah?
Yeah.
And so I went home, I dug it out of my closet, my storage box, and I went back to the hospital. I took away all the Buddhist statues and the Buddhist, you know, banners and things, and I set up an altar with this little plastic Jesus, right? Because, you see, what was happening for John is he was, for Matthew rather, is that he was having this feeling of a wrathful God, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't really seeing the merciful side.
Mm-hmm.
So I, just as I'm cleaning, smoothing out this altar cloth, in walks a home health aide, a nurse's assistant. And she looks at the statue and she said, "Merciful Jesus. When merciful Jesus is here, it's all right." And John's eyes just turned to her, and they locked eyes, and then he looked back at the little plastic statue. And something changed. Something changed. And I think that what happened was he took this young woman's faith in God and he borrowed it, kind of like what I was saying about the blind boys.
Yeah.
And it completely shifted his relationship to his, in his case, his creator, to his sense of God. And that aggressive, wrathful God, that one that was the punishing God, got transformed into the gentle heart, the sacred heart, we could say, of Jesus, the kind and merciful one. Yeah. And when I saw this happen between this home health aide and Matthew, I just said, okay, my work's done. I don't have to do anything. I left, you know, and I came back the next day, or later that day, rather, and John was sitting up eating Jell-O, you know, and feeling really good, you know. So, again, I think, you know, how did this happen? It happened with love, you know.
Yeah.
Love's what helps us get free. Love is the ally that makes acceptance possible.
Yeah. The fourth invitation, just when I read it, I was just reading the book page by page, and I got to that, and I just had to sit with it, and that is, find a place of rest in the middle of things. And I thought that was such a beautiful phrase, especially when so many of us are living what Wayne Muller calls crazy busy lives.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're always, you know, on to the next thing, right?
We're
busy trying to multitask, juggle as many plates as we possibly can. And we imagine that rest will come when we finish our projects or when our list is checked off or when we go on a holiday. But, you know, I don't know about you, but my list is never checked off. So if I wait for that, I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
So I have to learn to find rest right in the middle of what I'm doing. And I think we do that by bringing our attention fully and completely to whatever it is we're engaged in. You know, there was a woman I worked with. She was an 86-year-old Russian Jewish lady. Didn't care beans about meditation. The night she was dying, they called me. I went in to be with her, as I did with most patients. And as they walked in the room, she was sitting on the bed next to a home health aide, very well-meaning woman, who turned to this woman's name was Adele. She turned to Adele and she said, Adele, you don't have to be frightened. We're right here with you. Now, Adele was dying, and she was a tough cookie, and she turned back to this home health aide. She said, honey, if this was happening to you, you'd be scared.
Mm.
Yeah. And so I stayed in the corner, you know. and then after a little while, this very well-meaning home health aide said to her, you know, you look a little cold. Would you like a shawl or a blanket around your shoulders? And, Adele said, of course I'm cold. I'm almost dead.
You know?
So I saw a couple of things there. One is I saw that she was struggling. She was struggling with the dying process. In her case, the struggle was showing up in her breath. And even though we'd had all the right interventions, oxygen and morphine, et cetera, she was still, there's a labor to dying, like there's a labor to getting born. And that was the first thing. And the second thing I saw was that she didn't want any nonsense. She wanted real relationship, honest integrity in exchanges with her. So I pulled up my chair in front of her. I knew her very well. And I said, Adele, would you like to suffer a little bit less? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, I noticed something. Right there at the end of your exhale, before the next inhale, there's a little gap, a little pause. I said, what would it be like if you put your attention there just for a moment?
Yeah.
Now, remember, she doesn't care beans about meditation or any of these things, but she's highly motivated to be free of suffering.
Right.
So I said, I'll breathe with you. So I did it. As she would breathe in, I would breathe in. As she would breathe out, I would breathe out. And I oriented her attention a little bit to that gap there. And as she, her attention went to rest in that gap between the exhale and the next inhale, you could see the fear in her face just drain away, just drain away. And she said, I'm going to lay down now. And she laid back against her pillow, and a few minutes later, she died very peacefully. So what happened there? I think what happened is that Adele, you know, all the conditions were still the same. She was still dying. There was still shortness of breath, et cetera. But Adele found a place of rest in the middle of things. In her case, she found it in that gap between the exhale and the next inhale.
Right? Yeah.
So that's always available to us, that place of rest. Yeah.
That's a beautiful story.
The
fifth invitation is cultivate don't know mind. And what I wanted to talk to you about in that chapter is when you bring up the word surrender, you know, a lot of people, when it comes to dying, will use the phrase letting go. And you write two things that I'd like for you to share more about. You write, surrender is not the same thing as letting go. And then later you say, I'm not convinced that surrender is a choice.
Yeah. Well, letting go, and we're familiar with this term, of course, it has to do with sort of setting something down. You know, we set down a view or we set down an object, and we distance ourselves in some way from that experience, and so we have some freedom from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very healthy and necessary part of our process, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a choice in it. There's still me doing it. You know, I can choose to lose 10 pounds, right?
Right.
Surrender is something a little bit different. In letting go, we distance ourselves from a particular object or problem or state of mind. In surrender, we find ourselves coming closer, closer to something, something that we already know, that we're familiar with, but we've become more intimate with. surrender has a, when we surrender, the feeling that comes over the mind and heart and body is one of expansion, one of, you know, extending our awareness, really, to a much bigger, much broader space. Mm-hmm. And remember, we, when we talked about Carl, I said, whatever we can give space to can move.
Yes.
So when we surrender in the time of dying, or when surrendering happens in the time of dying, you know, there's a releasing. There's the releasing that we have in letting go, but there's a greater, there's a bigger expansion. We're not limited by our notions of ourself or our stories from the past or our limiting identities. We start, those things start to get surrendered. The edges soften. The boundaries begin to loosen a little bit. And we find ourselves in a much more expansive state.
Yeah, and talking about an experience to teach you that, you had a white water rafting experience. I've done some white water rafting on the New and Gully River in West Virginia. I'm not sure where your experience was, but surrender really does mean going into the flow, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it's not always pleasant. I mean, it happened to me. I was going down the Grand Canyon, and the Grand Canyon is a wild river.
My.
You know, that, and I got thrown out of my raft and into what they call a hole or a big whirlpool.
Yeah.
And I did all the wrong things. You know, I started swimming with all my effort to try and get out of the hole, and really what you have to do is release. And I did all the wrong things. And finally what happened was I got exhausted from my effort to try and swim out of this whirlpool.
Mm.
And in the exhaustion, the river took me down. Mm. It took me down under the water. Mm. And it wasn't a pleasant experience. I wasn't seeing tunnels of light, you know. It was felt chaotic and dangerous and scary.
Yeah.
But then what happened is right in the middle of all that, and this happens for people in car accidents and other kinds of things, everything started to slow down. And I began to see things in a almost moment-to-moment way.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I was perfectly safe.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what happened, I was perfectly safe.
Mm-hmm.
And the river took me and it sucked me down under deeper, further. And eventually it spit me out in an eddy down the river a little bit.
Yeah.
And I came out of that river with fresh eyes. I really came out having really understood something about the experience of surrender. Now, I don't equate this to what happens to people when they're dying, but it helps me to be able to build a bridge to their experience.
Absolutely.
From that experience.
Absolutely.
So surrender, you know, acceptance of Elizabeth, my great mentor, had those very five famous stages, and acceptance was the last of them.
Mm-hmm.
But acceptance is still just the beginning of things. It's the beginning of transformation. After acceptance can often come a kind of chaos. And after chaos can come a much deeper state than acceptance, and that's surrender.
Mm.
And surrender becomes the gateway for transformation, for understanding we're much more than the small, separate self we've taken ourselves to be.
Yeah. What's the most important lesson you hope for readers to take away from this book?
Don't wait, you know. don't wait. That's why I made it the first invitation. Don't wait to, you know, turn toward this experience of dying, this thing that frightens us, and begin to get familiar with it. Sit down with it. Have a cup of tea. Start talking to your friends and family about it. See what it is that scares you about it. And see also what's the wisdom that death has to show us about living a life of integrity and meaning and purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
If we discover at the end of our lives what's most important, why wait until the end of our life to benefit from that information? And to make different choices in our life.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, death is the most democratic thing on the face of the earth, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. None of us get out of here alive.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. And also, what was your motivation behind co-founding the Zen Hospice Project?
Well, you know, I thought that there was a natural match between people who were cultivating what I might call the listening mind or the listening heart in meditation practice and people who really needed to be heard for once in their lives, and that was folks who were dying. And I thought that would be a natural match. And we didn't, frankly, have much of a plan beyond that. But we started working with people on the streets of San Francisco, people who lived on park benches and in small, you know, SRO hotels. And what we found there is that while the conditions of their life might look very different than ours, fundamentally, we were not so different. We were both human. We were both human beings trying to be happy, doing our very best to move toward that experience. So I feel like what we tried to do there was kind of a fusion of spiritual insight and practical social action. Yeah.
Yeah.
Taking care of folks who were dying of cancer and AIDS and other illnesses who were living on the streets of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were remarkable people. I mean, sometimes they blossomed and they, you know, found the forgiveness and kindness they've been looking for their whole lives. And other times they turned toward the wall in withdrawal and hopelessness and they never came back again.
Yeah.
But all of them were my teachers, you know?
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful people.
And finally, I'd like for you to talk about just your insights on what you've been learning about impermanence. Impermanence is a central teaching in Buddhism, but to me, it's become one of the most powerful words in my life right now.
Yeah, I mean, so impermanence simply means everything's coming and going.
Yeah.
Everything's coming together and falling apart, and it's happening all the time. A tree falls in the woods and becomes something else. So impermanence isn't just about endings, it's about becoming. You know, it's the law of change and becoming, we could say. Now, when I come into harmony with that truth, instead of resisting it, you know, I begin to understand that my nature and the nature of the world are not appreciably different. And then the fact that things are not fixed or solid, this becomes a liberating opportunity rather than a threat.
Mm.
So things are all falling apart, Richard. They are. Things are continually changing. You know, where is this morning's breakfast and last night's lovemaking? Where, for God's sakes, is my blonde hair that I had when I was younger? But all this change is happening against a background of perfect harmony.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And when we don't see that background, we only see the change, all we see is suffering.
Yeah.
So we have to develop a capacity to be with our experience. Like when you're afraid, Richard, do you know you're afraid?
Yes.
Right. And so how do you know you're afraid?
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
Something happens in a physical experience, maybe.
Absolutely.
Your
heart's beating.
Tight.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Or your tongue sticks to the roof of your mouth. You begin to get familiar with those cues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
The part of you that knows that you're afraid, it's not afraid. It's not afraid. Mm. The part of you that's aware of that fear is not afraid. And we can learn to orient either toward the fear or toward that awareness, toward that knowing that can be with the fear.
Mm.
So we're always trying to get rid of the fear. My encouragement is learn to be with it. Find that part of yourself that can be with the fear, that won't run away, that
yeah.
can stay in the room when the going gets tough.
Yeah.
And we can all cultivate that capacity. And it's there for us. It's a natural, innate capacity that all of us have. And we can cultivate our relationship with it.
Yeah, and this teaching of impermanence has everything to do, I think, with even peace and justice, because as you have said, the beauty is that our impermanence binds us to every other human being.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Frank Ostaseski, it has been such a joy and a delight for you to share your time with us today. And by the way, you're writing articles for Spirituality and Health as well.
I am. I've started doing some article writing for them, so people can find me online at Spirituality and Health, or they can come to our website, which is 5invitations.com, and learn more about our work there.
Frank, thank you for sharing your time with us and shining your light in this world.
You're very welcome. Nice to be with you.
And now here's a beautiful song written and performed by Tina Malia. Tina's been a guest on this program numerous times. The song is called Shores of Avalon. It's from her Shores of Avalon album, and it's a song that she wrote after her mother died in memory of her mom.
Fragrant air The other night, you came to me like an angel. You appeared, and we climbed. Looking out upon the world that we've known, all fear will be gone when we reach the shores of Avalon. When we reach the shores of be brave, my love.
I want to thank Frank Ostaseski for being a guest on this show, and I love this book. You can learn more about him and this book by visiting 5invitations.com. And that's today's program. Man, I want to thank engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan, and you've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.